Voices Radio Network.
The views and opinions of Muscle Minds is for entertainment and educational purposes only.
Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology. We have the capability to make the world's first bionic man. Better than he was before. Better, stronger, faster.
Welcome to Muscle Minds with Dr. Scott Stevenson and Scott McNally, part of the Advices Radio Network, a new voice in bodybuilding podcasting.
Welcome back to Muscle Minds. I'm Scott McNally, and with me, as always, is Dr. Scott Stevenson. Scott, welcome back to the Midwest. Where are you right now?
I am sitting in the kitchen of my aunt in my hometown of Quincy, Illinois.
Oh, really?
Yeah. She's out of town just for a little while, and it just so happened. It was sort of coincidental and lucky for me in a way, but it would be actually better to see her. But so she lent me her house as nice. She had the previous time was 8 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was the same situation. She just happened to be out of town.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's good because I didn't know exactly how it would work. My parents actually took off and they're back in Florida. And they don't have a fenced in yard, but my aunt has had up to 5 dogs here.
Oh, wow.
Before. Yeah.
So it runs in the family.
Years. Oh yeah. There's a dog gene thing. Yeah. We've got both copies, double dominant, you know, dog gene.
Yeah.
Dog lover gene. And, so she's got this is actually my grandmother's house.
Okay.
The property has been in the family for forever. And, when she passed, my aunt and uncle moved in and took over the house. And so it's really big yard. It's well fenced off. It's great for dogs. So it's nice to have a big yard to let them run around in and sniff and pick up on Midwest scents.
Now, does Casey Reed Latz live there still?
Yeah, he does. He does. Oh, he's nice. He's probably going to get pissed because I literally got in yesterday. I met with my folks. And then because I've been bouncing around all over the place, I'm way behind on all sorts of shit.
Wow, shit.
I'm leaving tomorrow, literally. My parents have already taken off. I would probably just leave, but I want to give the dogs a little bit of a respite from the road.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, so, and this is a nice place. So I've got one buddy who contacted me. And, I mean, see, you know how this is, but my hometown's really small. And somebody found out, a buddy of mine, which is just totally fine, of course, he found out that I'm in town. He said, hey, you're going to be up to Quincy? And I'm like, yeah, so we're going to try to grab some food. But if I were to, like, had announced, hey, I'm going to be in Quincy,
yeah,
it would have been mayhem.
Yeah.
Because, and this is nothing, like, there's nothing wrong with this, but there's a lot of people that are still here, like, it's really kind of a big deal when someone
comes back. Yeah.
Been around for very long. I had a lot of close friends, people I grew up with, and it's like, oh, like something different, because we used to always joke, even back when I was growing up, Quincy is the town where time stood still, because it literally is like that. It's so crazy driving. It looks smaller every single time I go back. I know my way around, of course, because I grew up here.
Yeah.
I know where everything is pretty much, except for the stuff that popped up, but everything's very much the same and eerily reminiscent of a time, you know, decades ago for me. But so anyway, I just have to, I wish if I could stay longer, then it'd be cool. But I just have so much time. I have stuff I just kind of have to do. It's like, you know, deadlines. I've got something like a project I need to work on and a couple other things. So anyway, I'm just here for the day. And plus I need to rest. Cause I get on the road when I'm tired, it sucks.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No question. Yeah. I'm actually looking at pictures of Quincy, Illinois right now.
Oh,
I see like really old historic buildings.
Yeah. John Wooden Mansion probably popped up.
I'm not sure to tell you the truth, but okay. I'm seeing a bunch of them. I'm seeing bridges, big bridges, water. What are you on over there?
Right on the Mississippi.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I jumped off a train bridge in the Mississippi River when I was a kid at one
Did
point.
Did you really?
Yeah. Well, actually, there was one that's like we found out about. It's like, ooh, you can jump off this train bridge. And I jumped and was in. Because I was kind of a daredevil, like, you won't jump. I'll pay a dollar to jump. Oh, you
yeah,
will?
Yeah.
I'll pay a dollar. I think I got like 20 bucks.
Nice.
Another kid followed me. He jumped and he broke his neck.
Oh, Jesus. Did he live?
Yeah.
Did he live?
Yeah. I mean, this isn't like any, you know, huge hero story, but he hit the water and he knocked the wind out of himself and the current was, it wasn't terrible there, but it's obviously not the brightest thing to be jumping into the Mississippi when you haven't tested the waters, and the current was taking him away.
Oh, wow.
And I had to go back in the water and bring him over because he didn't realize he had broken his neck until later. It hurt. He was kind of messed up from the jump.
Wow.
Pretty high train bridge, I think, but
yeah.
Yeah. So there's a big bridge. Hannibal, Missouri is right across the river. That's where Mark Twain grew up, and that's where Tom Sawyer, Huck Finn.
No kidding.
Place. Yeah.
No
yeah.
kidding. Wow.
Yeah. So there's a Mark Twain restaurant here in Quincy, and we used to ride our bikes across the Mississippi River across that bridge to pick up fireworks during the 4th of July.
You could get them over in Mississippi, or I'm sorry, in Missouri for like better fireworks over there or something.
They were illegal in Illinois. You couldn't get them. So,
I see.
But they'd sell them to 12-year-olds.
Yeah, they would.
Yeah, and then we'd pick up the fireworks and ride back across the. I mean, this was a pretty far trek for a kid. I'm talking, it was probably 10-mile round trip on a bike.
But it was worth it.
that bridge is not very big. It was like a 2-lane bridge.
Oh wow.
And yeah, so people are honking. What are you doing?
Yeah, kid? Yeah.
We load up on the bottle rockets and we come back and we just raise cane in the neighborhood, riding down the street in the middle of the night, shooting lighting bottle rockets and shooting them off at each other on our bikes, trying to launch them into people's windows and shit.
Oh, man.
I mean, obviously we were just kind of normal kids, but we thought we were hellions.
Right. Yeah, I'm looking at a picture of the downtown area. It looks like there's a square there where all the buildings are connected, wrapping around the downtown, and exactly what I expected. Square.
Yeah.
Exactly what I expected.
If you remember from when Lats was on, I think we might have mentioned, this is, so we'll connect it with what I'm doing here. At that square is where the Spectrum Gym was.
Okay.
The very first gym that I trained at, and that's where I first saw Casey.
Huh.
In a basement.
Wow.
Yeah, and the connection with this weekend is Chad Nichols was at the grand opening for the House of Pain Gym.
Okay.
In Chesterfield, St. Louis area.
Okay.
And he and Kim are from Decatur, Illinois.
Oh.
Yeah, that's where they first were. And I remembered hearing stories of Kim coming into the Spectrum, like when she was first starting to bodybuild. And because I heard those stories from people who've been there forever.
Yeah.
And I mentioned it to Chad. I'm like, he's like, yeah, I remember that gym. I remember going in there. So that gym's long gone. It probably hasn't been open for 20 years, something like that. But that was the gym, man. That was the hardcore gym. It literally was a basement gym. You walk down in there, like it was, you know, if something caught fire down there, everyone would have been trapped and died.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the stairwell was really near. It was like a one-person stairwell. You know, two people couldn't walk on that thing at the same time because it was so narrow. So, but yeah, that's right on Washington Square where you're looking.
So, tell me a little bit more about what took you out there this weekend.
It was, Joe Corbett, my friend Joe Corbett, who's an IFBB pro. We mentioned this, I think, on the podcast a couple of times now, but we finally had the grand opening for his gym.
Nice.
He owns House of Pain Apparel.
Okay.
And he opened a gym. He basically he's just gotten to that place where he can like just have his own gym.
Nice.
He's in his 50s. He got his pro card at the Team U a couple of years ago in classic physique. But he competed as a bodybuilder all that time. He just sort of like, you know, finally I'm going to just try to like play the size game, and got his card at his first attempt. And so he's living his dream, man. He's got the House of Pain Apparel and the gym, And the gym's a great gym, man. Yeah. He's picked out all the pieces himself.
Nice.
He's got that Strive, the plate loaded Strive stuff. There's a new brand name I keep on forgetting, but it's where you can, depending on which peg you load the weight, it will change the resistance curve through the range of motion.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the same thing I trained on with John Meadows when I was up in Columbus, at American Barbell.
Nice.
Funny, they have a lot of the same equipment.
Huh.
Yeah, like that's, you know, they both had a lot. I mean, even some things like Joe's like, hey, check this out. And he had a like a nylon strap with multiple hooks on it for adding chains to a bar.
Okay.
So you just, you can hook one, hook it onto the bar at one point, and then the nylon strap had multiple hooks, multiple loops to add more chains.
And nice.
Just hooked the carabiner. He's like, this is cool. I'm like, yeah, John just bought one of those for the gym up in Columbus.
Yeah.
Same thing. So it was kind of eerie. There's such, so many, you know, great minds thinking alike.
Yeah.
Up equipping the gym the very, very same way. So, so he had a meet and greet, all the people I've mentioned before, Jessica Reyes Padilla, she's a figure competitor, was there. Natalie Graziano was there.
Oh yeah.
So she was seeing people. Mitch Statz lives locally. Great. Fucking
oh, cool.
Dude. Mitch is awesome.
Yeah.
Mitch, cool guy. Yeah. I like Mitch. Got to meet his wife. We had sushi twice. of course, Dave was there. And
oh,
Dave's
yeah.
He came too. So we had a meet and greet on Friday. And then the day was just then jam-packed. We had a local speaker who's a psychologist, kind of a performance optimization psychologist came.
Yeah.
Her name's Michelle Burghardt, very nice woman. And then I gave a talk, and then Dave and Mitch and I, or while I was doing that, Dave had a barbecue cook-off with a local powerlifter
who's okay.
also part of the House of Tame. I don't even know what happened, to be honest.
Yeah.
So crazy. Yeah, I was just like running around. My parents showed up. My cousin showed up with his wife and one of his sons. A longtime friend from here in Quincy was in the area, so she swung by.
Nice.
And we trained. Mitch and Dave and I trained. We did some fortitude training, muscle round workout, you know, for the crowd.
Okay.
Arash Rabar was there.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Got second in the Arnold this year, and he's helping out Jessica. So he did a Q&A while we were training. I missed that. And then Chad Nichols was here too.
Nice.
Very cool. Yeah.
Dan Solomon?
Dan didn't make it. Dan,
wow. Okay.
Yeah, something come up. He couldn't make it. So, yeah, unfortunately, that would have been awesome. I keep on missing him for some reason. Like, he's been in Tampa, and I missed him at the Tampa Pro. And we both live in Florida, but eventually we'll connect.
Yeah, no kidding.
So Chad just kind of gave sort of historical perspective. It's one of those things where it's Chad. You like, people don't want to ask questions because they don't know what to say. Like, you know, like it's Chad Nichols. It's like, what do you ask Joe Weider?
Yeah.
You know, like, what do you say? So I didn't want to butt in, but I asked him what I thought was a cool question. I got an interesting answer people might be interested in. So I said, this just occurred to me. I said, what, Chad, if you could go back in time and pick any bodybuilder ever and train him, optimize his diet, his training, all the things that you have done, the things you did for Ronnie, because he talked about Ronnie a good bit.
Yeah.
Who would that be? He said, Bob Paris.
Really?
Yeah, whose beautiful lines were just amazing.
Yeah,
and presentation was phenomenal. And I said, yeah, you wouldn't expect that, right? You're thinking, you know, somebody else who was, because he knew Nasser really well.
Okay,
and of course Nasser, you know, is one of those guys, uncrowned Mr. Olympia type of guy, or you know, would he've gotten hold of Sean Ray and
yeah,
you know, tried to like you know give him an extra 5-10 pounds and. You know, push him over the edge to beat somebody, to beat Ronnie maybe, or what have you.
Yeah.
But he said he thought he could have put about 40 pounds on Bob Paris.
Imagine that.
I know. I started like thinking about that. And then it occurred to me, Bob Paris wrote a book years ago called Gorilla Suit.
Okay.
And I asked Chad, kind of a follow-up, I said, have you read Bob's book, Gorilla Suit? And he had, and I don't think he'd maybe even heard of it. And the interesting thing about that book, and I read it a long time ago, so I can't remember the details, but basically it's sort of, you know, his chronicles in bodybuilding, but the slant is, as the title suggests, You know, this is really, we're talking about an aberration of our physical form here to some degree. And he had a very critical and unique and personal perspective on, you know, how much muscle's too much, what sort of violates natural laws of symmetry, artistic design of the human physique, that sort of thing. Yeah. It's a well-written book from what I recall. And I said, given what I remember from that book, this is sort of the bottom line is I don't know that Bob would have done what he wanted to get there, even if he could just wave a magic wand.
Yeah.
You know, and didn't have to change anything. He wouldn't have wanted that physique. I had the sense that he got where he got, and he was maybe even thought that he had too much, even when he was, you know, at his physical best, his largest, so to speak, but, you know, it may have been not in his optimal. I have to go back and read the book. I've got it somewhere at home, I think.
Yeah. But, I guess there's so many factors, you know, would Bob Paris, would his perspective be different if he were to see, you know, what the modern guys looked like, you know, like, cause he couldn't compare that to, he didn't know what a 300-pound bodybuilder looked like at the time, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. But he's back then, you know, he's in roughly the Lee Haney days. And, yeah, I don't know if it would have changed. I mean, I'm trying to think of an example of someone who's most people, their symmetry perspective, their sort of opinions, their taste.
Yeah.
Kind of get set up and like they don't change. It's not like all of a sudden they see, you know, they're not big on getting as much muscle as possible. Then they see Dorian Yates and their mind gets changed.
Yeah, I don't know. I could argue that.
Happen to someone like you or have you?
I would say that my taste has evolved. You know, I would say that, you know, I'm influenced by what I see and I've come to appreciate looks that maybe I didn't at first like as much, but then I start seeing like what the value in it, I guess, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that would be a big stretch to say, you know, going from like, I mean, Lee Haney was huge, you know, but compared to somebody like Ronnie or, you know, what some of the guys have been able to do even since then, just with packing on sheer muscle. I mean, like, I think even though Ronnie was bigger than Branch, I feel like Branch to me, like put on as much physical mass as you could to the point where it didn't look pretty anymore. But
yeah,
I came to appreciate that look, you know, at the same time, it was a very different thing, I guess, than, you know, what Bob Paris would do. I wonder how, you know, I feel like that society kind of influences us as much as, mm-hmm. you know, we form our opinions. I wonder. Of course, it's a question that can't be answered, you know?
Yeah, well, we can ask Bob, you know?
That's true.
Get him on the show. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm looking, I just kind of, as you were talking there, I was looking to see, you know, pictures of him on stage and what have you, and his books popped up. He's written more books than I was aware of.
Really? Really?
Yeah. Nothing since the 90s, but of course, he was gay, and he was, you know, somewhat known, interestingly enough, I don't remember being that big of a deal. You know, it was never like, you know, oh God, he's gay. Like he'll never place or something like that. It's not really, it was never really counted against him. It's just kind of known, but
really,
not that I remember. I mean, what's his name? Chris, Mr. Olympia, Chris, blanking on his last name. He won the Olympia once. He's an opera singer, black guy. How can I forget his name? Anyway, he was gay, and I don't think that ever. I mean, probably some people, but he won the Mr. Olympia.
Yeah.
God, how can I forget Chris Dickerson?
Oh, Chris Dickerson. Thank
just
you.
Came to me. Jeez, gosh.
I didn't. Yeah. He was gay.
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
Gay. Yeah, that wasn't like a big exactly right. You didn't know that. There, that's kind of speaks to my point. It didn't ever matter. Sorry, that phone's going to probably go. That's my.
You're in the call center.
I'm in the call center. It's just telemarketers.
Has nobody told your aunt that nobody uses landlines anymore?
No, I don't think so. She hasn't gotten the text message about that.
Right, right.
Yeah. It was the first time it rang or at the other end of the house in the bedroom, in the spare bedroom. and it has a little voice that tells you who's calling. You know, it's kind of an advanced landline, and yeah. my dogs are like, "What the hell is that?" They were on high alert.
I bet.
Because they're not, you know, they're not used to television either. I turn a TV on, they freak out at first.
Really?
Because I don't have a TV. I don't watch television. So they don't know what that is. They think it's a real thing.
That's funny. My dog does the same with animal shows, especially. She watches the TV when there's animals on it. Yeah, and she will try to get in the screen and get them.
So cute.
And then look behind the screen, too. She'll walk around and look behind the TV for them.
Right, right. How can this be? What is this?
Right, right.
Yeah. So... anyway, yeah, it would be interesting, you know, to know. There's probably, maybe someone's done an interview. I mean, obviously, that would be the question, since Bob Paris is sort of renowned for having, you know, had one of the most classic physiques, not overly sized physiques, but really well muscled. I'm sure he's been asked that in a multitude of interviews. So
it wouldn't. I don't know if it would be great for him to. You know what I mean? What do you think? Would 40 pounds? Did you say 40 or 60, 40 pounds?
40, I think is what Chad said. Yeah.
I wonder if 40 pounds would look good on him, or whether it would take away those lines.
I think this is why Chad said him, is because, you know, Chad's got a great eye, and his eye was telling him that with Bob's structure and his lines, that those 40 pounds would still flow amazingly.
He could handle it, huh?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, look at Ronnie. I mean, when Ronnie was first competing before Chad, he was he got his pro card at the World Championships probably as a natural competitor, people suggest.
Yeah.
And he was like I want to say he was like a heavyweight. He was like in like the 220s, something like that. Maybe 219 or something.
Okay.
And then when he was first competing, he wasn't, you know, more than 240 or 250, still big. And then he got up to 300 pounds.
Yeah.
You know, close to 300 on stage. And before, you know, the waist started going a little bit and some of the other things, when he was like in 2003, like full blown, and he still had flow and roundness. It didn't, he didn't lose, you know. It was if he did lose symmetry, so to speak, it was more than made up for with increase in size and muscularity and conditioning. Everything else came with it. So
sure.
I think Chad thinks that Bob would have been able to hold those 40 pounds really well.
That's an interesting question. That had to be really cool. Sounds like the whole weekend was just a lot of fun too. I imagine you're tired now. I'd be beat from that.
Well, it's Tuesday now, so yeah, I was tired Sunday,
yeah,
for sure, man. I was wiped out because we trained really hard too.
Yeah,
we had a fun time. It was one of those things, we trained and then we hung around and didn't eat. Like didn't have anything to eat. Yeah, I think I had like a protein bar, and we're like waiting. You know how big events can be with big people, or the people are getting caught, and you know everyone's going a different direction. It's like, okay, we're gonna go eat now, and then. It's an hour later before everyone's finally mobilized. Like everyone has agreed, we want to go eat.
Right.
And just like turning and walking out the door seems like, you know, everyone's under some mind control and they can't do that.
Oh yeah.
For whatever reason. So it was one of those things where definitely underfed and overstimulated over the course of the weekend, but totally worth it. It was really cool.
So you said, you guys did a fortitude style workout. What did you train?
Back, chest, delts, and tris.
Okay.
Yeah, day four of the system.
Nice.
I should probably mention, because I'm getting more and more people now through John's videos, and just, you know, there's some sort of momentum building that people think fortitude training just means doing muscle rounds.
Yeah, okay.
And it doesn't. Like, that's just one of three set types
that's
done on two of the 4 days of the training. And you'll see me do those when traveling or what have you. And when using unique exercises, which is why they see those on my Instagram, because the nature of that set type, the muscle round set type, is one where you auto-regulate your exercise selection.
Okay.
So, like, if I were to show my loading sets, you know, they would be the same exercise. I'm rotating through three sets of exercises, and they're just straight sets.
Yeah.
And you just see me doing a hard, you know, heavy straight set. The last one would be the last compound would be to failure, and it wouldn't be nearly as fascinating. Say, oh wow, you put a band on that machine and this, and it felt real. I'm doing that because I have a hard time hitting my X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
So as far as informational density, it's much richer to post the muscle rounds, but then that gives people the impression that 4D training is just doing muscle rounds on crazy exercises.
That's all you do, muscle rounds the whole time.
Yeah, people think that. People definitely think that's the case.
That's funny.
Yeah. So anyway, that's like a misnomer. It'll still persist, I'm sure, but I figured maybe a couple people would say, oh, okay, that makes more sense now.
Well, maybe they'll buy the ebook, guys. You can check that out over at fortitudetraining.net. Super cheap. It's a one-time purchase. And plus, Scott, with that, they can post questions at your message board too, right?
Yeah, the purchase email has instructions for getting on the board, and they just message me with their transaction ID, and I load them up.
Nice.
They've got like 3 years now of archives to dig through, and I answer questions literally about 350 days a year.
Nice.
I hardly ever miss a day unless something crazy happens. So.
Hey, I spoke to Paul Scarborough just yesterday.
Cool.
He's a really cool dude. You said you know him, huh?
I owe a lot to Paul.
Yeah? Actually.
Yeah, I really do. He found me on Intense Muscle. He'd worked with Ken before.
And, oh, no way.
Yeah. He worked with Ken for a while. And that's how he knew of me, I think. I mean, through the board and just, you know, word of mouth, what have you. And we worked together. I want to say it was close to a year.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, to connect it with Fortitude Training, the Family Man Plan was a version that I created for Paul.
Okay.
Paul is the infamous Family Man of the Family Man Plan, which is, you'll see in the book, it's a different version that there aren't even overview sheets for it, I don't think, that are printable in that way. Maybe they're on there, I can't remember, but it's a three-day-a-week plan because Paul came to me after he was in sort of pseudo retirement.
Yeah,
he wanted to spend more time with his family, so he wanted to be able to just train 3 days a week. So I made a modified version for him, and he did really well with it. I sort of introduced him, I believe, and he said this several times, to peri-workout recovery supplementation, which he hadn't really done much of before, and he really dug that. And we had great success together. He could tell you about that, but. I really totally enjoyed working because he's an older guy. He's mature. He asked great questions. He would, you know, he kind of had a sense like, okay, this is why I just need to trust my coach. This is why I hired him versus here's a good time to ask the question. He was just like a model client, and he's just a phenomenal guy. And then he did what was the coolest thing, which is why I owe him so much, is he just, whenever people would ask, he would mention me.
Wow, like, that's cool.
Yeah, so my notoriety in the UK is due basically was launched sort of by Jordan and Paul.
Okay, we should bring him on here sometime. I have a feeling he'd love to come on. We had a great conversation for a project I'm working for, Advices Radio, the program itself. And just great conversation. We could have continued talking forever. The plan was just to do a quick 30-minute show. Covering a few small topics, things like how competing works in the UK, the different organizations.
Oh, jeez. You know, that's not going to be a small conversation.
Quick overview of what different organizations or what the different organizations are, and, you know, stuff like that, stuff like what the gyms are like over there. And basically just kind of like a little foreshadowing of what I'm putting together. It's going to be just like a UK based episode, kind of like a British invasion program, I'll call it. And I've got a couple pieces. I spoke with him, and I spoke with Aaron Hudson, and I'd like to get one more guy on, maybe Luke. I'm gonna ask him, and, you know, see who else is out there that might want to come on the show. But yeah, we ended up going for over an hour, and there was so much more. And he seems, you know, he has his podcast, Prep Radio, it's called. They do a lot of Q&A type stuff. I feel like he would be right at home with the Muscle Minds.
Yeah. He has did he mention Prep the series?
He did.
Good. That's worth watching.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then from that spun off the podcast that they do.
Of course.
So, and he's doing well. He said, you know, he had some health concerns that right. he's kind of buttoned up now, and he's back in the gym. He's training. He lost a lot of muscle, but he's kind of on the road to trying to get back to, you know, just building muscle and doing the sport that he loves, not taking it to the extreme anymore, probably. But, you know, he's still real passionate about bodybuilding, and I think he'd have a lot to bring, you know?
Oh yeah, I mean, I love Paul. He's a great guy. He's really knowledgeable. He's sort of the epitome of a veteran.
Yeah,
he's seen a lot of stuff. He's competed a long time, and you know, he's definitely an insider over there. So,
and it's interesting because I feel like for us to find guests to come on and basically co-host the show with us, a lot of times it's got to be the right fit, you know, the right people together. And yeah, before I even knew that you knew him, I just thought like, hey, those guys would, I think they'd gel really well together. So I was onto something, I guess.
Yeah. Your intuition was dead on, man. Maybe we could, God, it's too bad you can't get over to Body Power this year.
Oh, that would be cool.
Yeah.
Does it look like you are planning to go still, or you're not up in the air still?
That's my plan. They've scheduled me for talks all 3 days.
Yes.
We haven't got a flight yet, but this is kind of how it's gone down, I think. So,
okay.
I got a dog sitter requested. I got a dog sitter nailed down. So they just get a guy. I just hope they get a. Hope they get me a flight. There was a couple that were great, perfect timing, blah blah blah. Everything would work great.
Yeah.
And then the other options, I had a 30-hour flight back home.
Ooh, geez. What's the actual like flight time? Without the layovers,
if you like direct flights are like 8 hours if you can do a direct one.
So 30 hours, man, that's a lot of hanging around.
It was going to be like 12 hours in Ireland or something like that, and then like 4 hours in JFK.
Whew.
And or something crazy, like just like, you know, and not like horrible like middle of the night hours too, like, you know, land at 1 a.m. and fly out at 4 or something.
Yeah.
So, you know, and you're losing a whole day. The flights, they get the flights that are available, then I could fly.
Yeah,
it would be
yeah.
like 13 hours
without ruining your sleep schedule and everything else, right?
Oh, yeah. It's just, I mean, I don't mind breaking up like that, and you can maybe get some work done or go do something almost, but like then you're stuck in an airport for 12 hours.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, we'll see. But anyway, I'm coming. I'm going.
Nice.
I'm 99% sure. So.
What are the dates on that?
Oh, it's right smack dab in the middle of May.
Okay.
So I can't remember because I'm flying in. I had to fly in like 2 days before because I lose time on the flight over. But it's like 11th to the 13th maybe.
Okay.
Something like that. You can go to bodypower.com and it pops right up.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, hey, what do you say we take a quick commercial break and come back and get to some questions?
Sounds perfect.
All right, guys. We'll be right back. If you've enjoyed Scott Stevenson's contribution to Muscle Minds, you can learn more about him, his products, and his services at fortitudetraining.net. And if you order any of his products or services, you get a free subscription to his message board where he answers questions daily. Go to fortitudetraining.net to learn more about all these products, services, and events offered by Scott Stevenson. Hey guys, Scott McNally here.
And this is VJ Peary.
You guys know us from here at the Advices Radio Network. Well, we also have another show, Bodybuilding Nerds Radio. We've got everything from supplement reviews
to shout outs,
listener questions,
and of course, our weekly bodybuilding podcast reviews.
So check us out every Friday.
Or whenever you feel like cooking or doing your cardio or basically wasting time with us.
You can hear us at bodybuildingnerds.com.
Also on iTunes. Bodybuilding Nerds, it's time to get nerdy.
All right, guys, and welcome back to Muscle Minds. I'm Scott McNally. Dr. Scott Stevenson and his dogs. I hear somebody shaking in the background over there.
That was a little spooky.
So questions. We were going to go back to one of the questions we were looking at last episode from White Ox, because we had talked about Whole Foods versus protein powders. He had a few more questions. We wanted to give other people a chance, but there was a really good one, and we wanted to tackle that today. He says, what influences androgen sensitivity negatively and positively? How can we maintain and improve sensitivity? And any remedies or supplements that can be beneficial to improve sensitivity? And guys, I just want to throw it out there too. If you want to submit some questions, feel free to do so. We obviously only get to a couple questions per show, but you can go over to Scott's message board. You could go to the Advices message board, and we can take your questions there. So feel free, post them up, and we will get to them eventually.
Cool.
So to start us out, Scott, androgen sensitivity, how is it affected negatively and positively? I think that there's a lot of misunderstanding about this. I think that people think that gear stops working altogether after a period of time. I think that's about as far as the average bro knows. And, you know, I know a little bit more than that, but I don't know as much as you. So I'm turning to you on this one.
So here's the thing. So the question is not, this part is not really long. What influences androgen sensitivity negatively and positively? How can we maintain and improve it? And then he asked about remedies or supplements that could be beneficial. And what I'm guessing he's doing to some degree is he's conflating or he's basically equating androgen receptor sensitivity with whether or not the gear works. And what I mean by that is I would have to ask him what he means by androgen receptor sensitivity.
Okay.
So that would be essentially a function of, in a more technical way, what happens when an androgen binds to its receptor in terms of the second messaging happens if it's one of the sort of hypothesized androgen receptors that's on the plasma membrane, or what happens when the androgen receptor bind or the dimer actually binds at the promoter regions for the androgen receptor element, where you then have some proteins that begin being produced in via transcription. So sensitivity of the androgen receptor is not the same as binding per se. Sometimes people, and I talked about that in the John Meadows seminar, I know you were there for, because just because something binds the receptor doesn't mean it activates it in a way that translates to some cellular change in metabolism. That's what you want. You could still have binding, and it could be in. There are anti-androgens that inhibit the androgen receptor, and then there are androgens that activate it in various ways. And that's the interesting thing, is that different androgens bind the receptor with different binding affinities and also produce different intracellular effects based on that. And that's kind of a whole other side topic, but there's other data. There's the data that suggests that, like, a lot of orals, like Winstrol, Dianabol, bind the androgen receptor really, really poorly. But then when they do, and I've talked about this on the podcast too, I think, preceding the Meadows thing, if you do, set up a cellular model where you look to see what happens in terms of gene expression after you expose the cell to those androgens, you can still get, you need a little bit higher doses, but you can still get the same maximal level of gene expression from those orals
that
you get from testosterone.
Yes.
So they can indeed bring about the gene expression, the cellular metabolic activity, the protein synthesis, and all those things that you'd want. So this is like a huge topic here to cover, but I'm going to try to do my best and try to keep it organized. So that's one aspect.
Okay.
The other thing that I presume is underlying his question is he's talking about androgen receptor sensitivity in the skeletal muscle. So, but you also have androgen receptors other places.
Okay.
Got them in the brain. So that's how you have, if you use an exogenous androgen, the androgen receptors in the brain will pick up on that, and then you will shut down the hypothalamic pituitary testicular axis. Hmm. So you might want to, in some way, you have to consider that. It's like you're talking about shutdown, for instance. There's different androgens that seem to affect the central, the cognitive effects of like things like sex drive and aggression differently.
Okay.
Orals, halotestin, anadrol tend to, they act really quickly. This is why people take them as pre-workouts.
Yeah.
So that's probably a different androgen receptor.
Okay.
And that's deep in the cell. The sort of classical genomic androgen receptor that produces increased rates of protein synthesis that happens over the course of days, you know, on a time scale of days and weeks. Whereas you take anadrol and you feel like a butthole in 35 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Halo or whatever. So those are different androgens, androgen receptors, probably. Because they found the second messenger pathways that are involved with some of those membrane bound androgen receptors. So there's that to consider. There's also what might be going on in the testes too. Like this is another like interesting thing. People use HCG to stimulate testicular testosterone production.
Yeah.
And the testes are somewhat responsive to androgens themselves. It's kind of the local androgen levels that are really most important for spermatogenesis and fertility and that sort of thing. But there's probably something that can happen there. There's a couple studies now suggesting that large doses of HCG, like 1500 IUs all at once, compared to using like 300 IUs, like five each day, every day, the latter, spreading the dose out, gives you more testosterone production or androgen receptor production. So that's not really technically androgen receptor sensitivity per se, but that's use of something that produces androgens, and you're getting it's an insensitivity issue if you overuse HCG.
Yeah.
So here's the thing. Obviously, what's really happening is some downregulation of the effects of the androgen receptor. A lot of studies, the data is kind of mixed, but a lot of studies show that if you expose cells to more androgens, you get the same. You don't get any change in androgen receptor density, and you may even upregulate it. So you may even get more androgen receptors.
Okay, I could kind of see that. I know that, and I don't know whether this relates at all, but I know that for people that use opiates, that you develop more receptors or dendrites to uptake more opiates the more you take.
Mm-hmm. But you definitely become desensitized to the effects.
Yeah, you do. Yeah.
And that's the main thing here, is that the cells are going to become desensitized in some way, shape, or form.
Okay.
And they will become desensitized, and you know this probably from your knowledge of opiates, and this goes for many drugs that act the same receptor, or they're acting on the same systems in the body, is that the desensitivity is somewhat a matter of the particular drug that you're talking about. So like one example, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories inhibit the cyclooxygenase enzymes, the type 1 or type 2 COX enzymes. And some people who have like chronic pain, headache pain or what have you, they find that they can keep their pain at bay more so if they rotate NSAIDs.
Okay.
So we'll use aspirin one day, Tylenol in one day, and then naproxen, and then back to aspirin. And it works really well. Whereas if they just stay on naproxen, you know, a couple of days into it, it's not working anymore. So maybe this is true for opiate users. They rotate oxycodone, OxyContin, you know, whatever other opiates they have available, and you get a better hit if you rotate through three of those. I'm kind of asking you this, Scott.
Oh, I don't know, to tell you the truth, because in my experience, you found one and you stuck with it.
Yeah. And that makes you want to increase the dose, but we know that different steroids have different effects.
Yeah,
different things. So some of that desensitivity, maybe, and this is speculation here because I haven't seen anyone like really elucidate this mechanistically. What you'd have to do is look at what happens if you somehow standardize the effects of one steroid, apply to a second one. And then look to compare if you then continue to apply the second one versus if you applied the first one, and see what happens with second messengers and cellular changes of cellular metabolism. So do you get, you know, like greater area under the curve in terms of protein synthesis if you, you know, go 2 days on with one steroid versus and 2 days on with another one and two, and just alternate every 2 days or every day, every other day, versus using the same one every day, day in and day out. Many drugs that show desensitivity, sensitization, it seems to be somewhat specific to those drugs. It's not all drugs, but that's a common finding. So back to his question is, this is why people stack drugs. This is why lots of guys who don't want to come off, how common is it? It's like, you know, I go with test and DECA, and then I switch, you know, to EQ and something else, and then I switch to something else, and I come back to test and DECA.
Yeah.
Or whatever. And so they rotate through those, and they seem to get, a lot of those guys probably aren't growing that much overall, but they'll get a little bit of a hit. They'll get a little bit of an effect by doing that. But if they just stay with test and DECA, nothing. You know, eventually they desensitize to the point where it wasn't evoking any further adaptation or further muscle growth or what have you. But you rotate. So that is basically working around the desensitization in terms of metabolic effects that happens. And maybe one reason why you can still do that is that it doesn't seem like it's like this universal pronounced effect of super physiological androgens to downregulate the androgen receptor. So the androgen receptors, they stay there. Something about their second messenger system is causing it, or whatever happens post receptor binding is a better way to generalize it. Something about the post receptor binding effects is desensitizing. But the androgen receptors seem to be staying around many cases. So that's why you can rotate drugs and you still have plenty of androgen receptors to receive those drugs. And if the desensitization is specific to the drug, then a new drug will solve your problem to a certain degree. So, but the most obvious, obviously, if people are kind of following what I'm getting at here, the most obvious way to regain sensitivity, so to speak, is to come off and come back on.
Yeah,
that's it. Training seems to upregulate. Weight training upregulates the androgen receptor. So we've known that for a long time. And that's kind of cool. That's probably one mechanism of adaptation. There's also data. Like there's some data showing that you can use anti-androgens and it doesn't prevent muscle growth. And, you know, there's even some animal models where you can remove the whole pituitary gland, so there's like no stimulus for testosterone at all, and the muscle growth isn't hampered. That's a compensatory hypertrophy. So they're not requisite. You don't have to have androgens for muscle growth, and you can block androgens with an anti-androgen and still get muscle growth.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's this. I may have mentioned this before. There's some really Goldberg did this a long time ago. They've actually this compensatory hypertrophy model. Like they cut the soleus and watch the gastroc grow when the animal walks around.
Yeah,
we talked about it. And they can hypophysectomize the animal. So you're taking out thyroid, you're taking out growth hormone, you're taking out androgen, testosterone, and you still get the same kind of growth.
That's so weird.
They can fast the animals. Like they eat nothing and they'll still get the same amount of growth, basically.
Huh.
And you can also remove insulin, so they give them streptozotocin. It poisons the beta cells of the pancreas, and they still get the same amount of growth. So that's go ahead.
We don't need any of these things. Are you telling me then? I'm so confused now because I know, right?
It's full info. So it, not that we don't need them, but what this tells us is that when you, and this I talked about this weekend. I've talked about it several times, and some things I've written is that this is kind of one perspective on the evidence suggesting that muscle growth is very much a locally regulated phenomenon, or can be, and it's the adaptation capacity, the plasticity of skeletal muscle is phenomenal. If and it can adapt to a tremendous stimulus. Now, in this compensatory hypertrophy model, you can like double muscle size in a matter of months. Mm. You can increase muscle size much, much, much faster than you would with resistance training. Mm. So you're basically just, you know, the muscle is just, it's growing at a phenomenal rate. What that suggests, you can't, and this is, I always point this back to the idea that you couldn't do this with an individual, like no one's going to do it, you know, for the whole body, because the overload, these animals have had the soleus cut and they just walk around and they regain normal activity. So their gastroc is getting overloaded all the time while they're walking around their cage. This is a study that I couldn't remember, and I found it a couple podcasts back. There's a I found a study with humans where, in order to remedy Achilles tendon tear, they do a tendon transfer with the flexor hallucis longus tendon, and that's the muscle that's pretty small muscle, but it actually lets you flex your big toe.
Okay.
And they take that tendon and you kind of lose that capacity, but they take that tendon and they hook it on the calcaneus or whatever may be left of the Achilles tendon, and to replace that angle of pull. So now you have a plantar flexor when you wouldn't have one any other way. Hmm. And if they see that muscle can grow up to 100% in size with CT or MRI, whichever they use in these studies. This is like a, you know, number of case studies that followed, but it was highly variable. But and that's in a matter of months or a year. That's 100% increase in muscle size. That's basically the same model in humans as in rats. Hmm. But that's loading all the time. This is people walking around, they're on their feet, you know, 5, 10,000, 15,000 steps a day.
Yeah.
You know, you just can't do that in the gym because your nervous system, your endocrine system, your immune system, those are all gonna fail if you try to train for 8 hours a day.
Yeah, right.
Not gonna work. Yeah. So it's not that those things aren't important. Those will add to the rate of growth and the amount of growth you get when you provide the stimulus of resistance exercise. But this tells us that the muscle is capable of responding more so if it could be exposed to a stronger stimulus. And in that event, it doesn't matter. The endocrine doesn't matter. The hormonal milieu that it's, at least, of course, in the short term with the starving, eventually the starvation would get to you.
Yeah.
What's happening there is that the rest of the animal is starving and it's liberating amino acids. You know, cortisol or cortisone in a rat is breaking down amino acids for glucose for the brain. Rats do better without food than humans do. They're pretty hardy, but so there's amino acids that are being taken up by that loaded muscle and incorporated. It's not like it's magically making protein out of thin air.
Right. Okay.
It's just basically borrowing it from other muscles.
Okay. What about supplementation to benefit or improve sensitivity? Is there anything to that? And I get where he's coming at here. He's thinking like maybe where my brain goes as, you know, a bodybuilding bro, you know, I take some downtime from my cycle or I want to extend my cycle. Is there anything you could take that would help you get more or get more quicker?
Yeah, you know, I nothing has popped into my head. I didn't try to do an exhaustive search.
Yeah.
To look into that. One thing, you know, that many guys will find is helpful, of course, is is pro-Byron.
Okay.
You know, and that comes down, you know, the idea that pro-Byron binds up SHBG, so less of, and this is probably with lower doses, and if you're on, you know, 2 grams a week or something like that, it's not going to make a difference.
Yeah.
Blitzy, I know, it's just a bird. You're good to go. Then that can help. A lot of guys get more out of a cycle that way. And that's not really changing the energy sensitivity, but it's quote-unquote a supplement. It's actually an androgen.
Okay.
That, you know, is freeing more things up. But I don't, you know, you're basically like, it's kind of like asking, you know, how can you make your aspirin work better?
Mm-hmm.
No, you essentially got 100% bioavailability. I mean, one of the things that that I haven't mentioned that's kind of back to this original part of the question is that androgen receptor sensitivity and binding actually is a function of your genetics. There are some, the base pairs CAG repeats, or I think it codes for a glutamine amino acid in the androgen receptor gene vary substantially from, like, I don't know, it's like 11 to 20 something repeats. It's a pretty long segment of the androgen receptor gene. And depending on how many of those repeats you have, the fewer, the better in terms of androgen receptor sensitivity. And they figured that out when they were trying to figure out why, actually why in particular there are racial differences in prostate cancer risk. And African Americans have a higher risk of prostate cancer, or blacks, whatever term they happen to have used in the study.
Yeah.
Studies are there. And that has been associated with different levels of androgen CAG repeats into the androgen receptor gene, which they've validated affects androgen receptor sensitivity. And that's a genetic thing. And that's actually passed on, that gene is carried on the X chromosome, from what I recall. So it's something you get from your mom, interestingly enough. So that's something that just kind of set in stone. You know, so the thing about receptor sensitivity would also be, I mean, there are things you can talk about, you know, whether using a 5-alpha reductase inhibitor like finasteride or dutasteride.
Yeah.
You know, people who use those will prevent testosterone converting to dihydrotestosterone, which is good for prostate cancer risk and hair loss. But if you don't have those issues, you wouldn't necessarily want to do that unless you're using nandrolone, because nandrolone binds the androgen receptor more tightly, probably activates it more tightly than dihydronandrolone.
Yeah.
So there's that. So there's looking at, you know, sort of figuring out what compound works best for you.
Yeah.
In the context of the biochemical soup of supplements that you might be using already. And that's just like, there's so many others, all the things we talked about at John's seminar with John, and, you know, finding that what works for you. So as far as supplements go, I don't know. There's probably something out there that's, you've been shown to have some effect, that I'm not thinking of, but in the context of someone who's using a whole bunch of stuff, you know, you're just, it's a, like a drop in the bucket when okay. you're at 1,000 milligrams a week. Just
yeah.
You know, crazy. You're already like, you know, tenfold above whatever it may be. You're tenfold above endogenous levels.
Yeah.
You're not gonna like change your androgen receptor sensitivity when you're, you know, battering it with that much androgen.
That makes total sense then.
Yeah,
it's not the answer I want to hear. I want to hear I can take something and yeah.
I hear you. That was a long ass answer, but hopefully that helps some folks out.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, like I said, it's not the answer I want to hear. I want to hear that there's a supplement out there that I can take it for 2 weeks and then get back on cycle and you know, hit it hard all over again. It'll be exactly the same, but I haven't found it yet.
I'll go and look. I think this question came up a while ago, and I haven't looked since then. I've been kind of busy, but maybe there's something out there that, you know, that people are using, or maybe some, you know, I'm sure there'll be a research chemical or something, probably something that can do it. But as to whether there's some practical impact, I don't know, you know?
Yeah. We speaking of research stuff, we have a question about peptides. This is from Lucky 13. He says, although there have been lots of questions, Although there have been lots of questions on MK677, something I don't understand is how it doesn't seem to cause a down regulation of GH secretion like CJC 1295 with DAC. I thought anything that caused an almost permanent bleed like effect of GH secretion rather than a more sporadic pulse-like effect would cause down regulation from the pituitary gland. Please help me understand.
The short answer is he is right.
Yeah.
I've seen people kind of say that. I think they're just trying to sell stuff.
I wonder.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple studies that are out there that aren't like too hard to find.
Okay.
I transcribed the numbers here when this question came up. There's one by Svensson et al. It's from 98. And they gave 25 milligrams of MK677. And GH levels, the peak GH levels at the beginning, the first dose, 2 and 4 weeks into it. This is daily usage.
Can I take a guess on when it starts to downregulate?
Sure.
Okay. I'm going to say 3 weeks, 4 weeks. Really? Okay.
Yeah. This study only looked at 2 and 4 weeks.
Okay.
There's another one I'll mention here too, but the first dose, then 2 and 4 weeks. This again, 25 milligrams a day, went from units or milli IUs per liter, 65 initially, down to 17 2 weeks later, and then 14. Yeah.
Wow.
The area under the curve, which is more indicative of what's going on there in terms of total GH release, went from 144 initially, like the first day, I guess, down to 33 and then 29.
Wow.
So 2 weeks, you're already basically downregulated to kind of a flatlined effect where you're at roughly a quarter of the initial effectiveness in terms of GH release.
Wow.
Yeah. The area under the curve is probably the most indicative, most important, but the same pattern was with the peak levels.
Okay.
The area under the curve and the units are always something funky that doesn't really matter. That's sort of indicative of the total GH release. It went from 144 initially, day one, down to 33 and then 29. Those last two are essentially equivalent. So 2 weeks later, it was down to roughly actually less than a quarter.
Wow.
The area under the curve, and then even lower than that, it'll be basically the same 4 weeks later.
Now, what's a normal level for somebody who is healthy?
That's pretty close to like no effect.
Okay,
I can look it up and see what their controls were. They may not have used a control. I think I looked for that.
Okay,
so you know you have to depends on if you're a man or a woman. Actually, the area under the curve is larger in a woman, and it's pretty variable.
Okay.
Depends on your diet too. Mm. You know, you'll have more growth hormone when you're eating less.
That makes sense.
And yeah,
I'm sure a lot of factors, age.
Yeah, definitely age.
Hmm.
Yeah. Exercise, of course.
Yeah. That's so weird. I felt like when I've taken, MK677, I get a really good, like increased quality of sleep when I first start taking it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's somewhere under 4 weeks that feeling goes away completely.
Yeah. And people probably desensitize in different ways. You know, if you're taking it while you're dieting, then, and maybe low carbs, you're not going to have, it's because it's a ghrelin agonist.
Mm.
So you may not be impacting the ghrelin receptor in the same way. You've got this agonist in there, but you don't have endogenous ghrelin affecting it.
Mm.
There's you know multiple ways you could kind of be throwing things off. So, I don't even know if it's orally bioavailable, but I don't know what extent that varies.
Oh yeah, that's a good point too.
yeah. There's lots of things you know. So, there's a lot to say for you. Look at the research like this, you know, and like in your sense was pretty good. It's like 4 weeks, there's nothing left. It's not doing anything.
Yeah.
Someone might say something. It's like, well, please just show me the research. Could you be great if you just, you know, sent me the study that tells me that, or why do you think that? But, you know, because there's been so much variability, like like I show in that Why You Don't Look Like a Pro talk that I did it for John's seminar.
Yeah.
And so many things will work awesome for some people and get nothing for someone else. Like, yeah. Literally no effect at all, or like no adaptation at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like, I'm not feeling anything. It's like, okay, well then, you know, it's possible that you're confused, or that, you know, you're got a nocebo effect going, you're not expecting it or whatever it may be. But it's also possible that you're just a non-responder to that particular intervention or drug or whatever it may be.
Sure. Yeah. That makes total sense too.
Another study, this one, Kopinski et al. This is from 96, about the same time. So they gave it for either 5 milligrams or 25 milligrams. And you're going to like this. IGF-1 remained elevated, but they actually measured total growth hormone secretion.
Okay.
And after 7 days of those daily doses, I don't think 5 milligrams did much going by memory. They just gave it at night. A week later, total GH secretion was back to the baseline.
Wow.
Pre-dosing. Wow. So 1 week. Hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, so much for that.
Kidding.
Yeah. I mean, like an EOD dosing might be smarter.
Hmm.
You know? I mean, who knows? There may be greater downregulation in the GH elevation with a dose that's excessive.
Oh, yeah.
Dose response, you know, maybe some people 10 or 15 gives them the maximum dose, whereas all 25 does is shut them down for a longer period of time or increase the refractory period.
Yeah.
Time between them when they'll be able to get a maximal response when they reintroduce the drug after they've discontinued it. So, yeah, that's, you know, so many questions that can't really be answered.
Yeah. I guess the only thing you could really do would be just test your blood every day, you know?
Even that, you know, because it's increasing the, you know, the area under the curve. You can get some, you know, peak increases, but you can miss your peak.
Mm.
They're making multiple measurements here. These are super pricey, especially back then, price experiments.
Yeah.
The other thing too is there's a 20 and a 22 kilodalton growth hormone isoform. And because this is inducing an endogenous release of growth hormone, people will have different ratios of those two. And I don't know there may be variations in the different secretagogues in terms of how they increase these different growth hormone isoforms on an individual by individual basis.
So one might be being measured in the study, but the other isn't. Are you saying?
Yeah. Or if you go, back then, I don't even know in the late 90s if they were aware. They're just probably measuring the 22 kilodalton, 191 amino acid growth hormone isoform.
Interesting.
And yeah, and that's what you'll get tested when you go in and get your blood drawn, you know, at Quest or LabCorp, what have you.
Yeah.
And so you might be getting this, like, really, this is the thing that I've, you know, thrown by people, because some people don't do well with growth hormone, just doesn't do much for them.
Yeah.
And I always said, I always thought, you know, and people would ask me about the growth hormone secretagogues, GH peptides. And I said, well, you know, it's possible that, you know, if you get a bump in the 20 kilodalton, because those have different effects. That one doesn't induce the same loss of insulin sensitivity, for instance.
Huh.
They've got a little bit different defense, and they're different growth hormone receptor isoforms.
You might be
someone who's a little more sensitive to that other isoform, and maybe you might get a good effect. You know, I'm not saying anyone do anything that's illegal, but, you know, just theoretically speaking, you might benefit from a greater endogenous release of that other isoform, which you wouldn't get if you were just injecting exogenous growth hormone.
Right.
Its typical form.
Hmm.
So some people might say, yeah, this works great for me. You know, I use a Pamarelin and the DAC one GRP 129, and it works phenomenally. Works great, and they might have the right growth hormone isoform and get a good 20 kilodalton growth hormone pulse, and that's what, you know, does the magic for them.
Yeah,
you know.
And you'd never know on a study or a test.
Yeah. You wouldn't be able to even measure what you're getting. I don't know. You'd have to go to a lab or find someone who would measure that other isoform. You have to go to probably an endocrinologist who's, you know, connected.
Well, it does kind of, I guess, make me feel like that I may have been on the right track thinking that shorter term use would probably be to my benefit. And honestly, if I were to use it again, I would probably even consider going for a shorter period of time than the 4 weeks I had gone before. I could see doing even a week on, a week off, something like that, you know. I mean, it gives me options. I'm just thinking in my head now, okay, so if that might not be optimal, then what is, you know? So,
well, the second study, it was, you're bound to baseline GH secretion in a week.
Yeah, but I mean, at least then I'd get everything I could out of it. And, you know, I'm probably go beyond, but still, you know, like you said, maybe every other day, but you know, I could try a week on, a week off and go mm-hmm. from there, maybe even break it down further, like you're saying, to every other day or something.
I don't know in that study if they even, let me look here real quickly. I got my database open. They might've just tested at, you know, just time zero and then 1 week.
Okay.
Yeah, I think they just tested then.
So really, it could have been 2 days is what you're saying.
I don't know if two doubt that, because, you know, people would have been probably saying, this shit doesn't do anything. I felt it once and there was nothing. Or,
yeah.
How long did the water retention stay for you?
For me, it was a few weeks.
Okay.
Yeah, a few weeks.
Yeah. And that, some of that could be IGF-1 related possibly. I don't know. Mm. That's not what it's generally thought to it's, you know, it's supposed to be GH's effect on aldosterone and ADH and that kind of thing. But yeah, so the water retention, it does, the IGF, that's interesting. IGF-1, which is a good thing to measure because, you know, we got the somatomedin hypothesis, growth hormone stimulates IGF-1 release from the liver, and that's would be indicative of what your growth hormone's doing. But that will, once you've elevated IGF-1, it'll stay that way for a long period of time.
Mm, okay.
A week or more. Once you've sort of bopped that balloon up high, it's going to be floating for a while before it comes back down to baseline.
Okay.
And especially, and that's reflective of your diet too. So if someone's like saying, okay, I'm going for it, I'm going to take the growth hormone or the MK677 or what have you so that I stay as lean as I can while I'm pushing my food, pushing their food will keep the IGF-1 elevated.
Okay.
So they may have elevated IGF-1 compared to a, you know, a baseline measurement before they start a blast.
Yeah.
A food and drug blast that is, they're elevated beyond simply because of the food and no longer the effect of the MK677.
Right.
Yeah. So
a lot more questions. That's all I hear.
And IGF-1 is also elevated by androgens too. Yeah, so you can, you know, it'll bump all those things. GH is a main contributor there, but still, and IGF-1 was elevated in that second study I mentioned. It may have remained elevated when, even though there's no GH. So there's some evidence right there that it stays elevated for prolonged periods of time,
right?
Even without the initial stimulus, which presumably elevated it in the first place. That's just the nature of the IGF-1 molecule and the binding proteins that keep it in circulation so it doesn't get broken down by the liver. That's, you know, they increase the half-life. That's what they do.
Yeah.
That's the nature of that system. So,
hey, I've got a fun question here to end the show on. It's about, cool. It's about your calf training.
Okay.
He says, Dr. Scott Stevenson mentioned briefly in a recent podcast that he has trained intensely his calves for years and even performed some of those DC recommended calf training techniques of completing a very slow eccentric and then holding the stretch position for a certain amount of time, then moving up to the next rep. However, he stated that even though he built the work capacity in his calves so much, so the amount of weight/load he got up on the exercise was beginning to cause lower back issues, yet his calves didn't get any bigger or more developed. Would you all agree that calf development is pretty much set in stone, genetically speaking, almost regardless of training techniques? Either you have them or you don't. It's one thing to feel intensity, the burn, the pump, increase the strength capacity of the calves, but it's completely different to have those calves actually grow. Have you come across any calf training regimen that actually resulted in bigger calves?
So, yes, you can make your calves grow with training.
Okay.
I'm not going to give him like the easy out and say, oh, no, totally 100% genetic.
You don't have to train them anymore.
You don't know. There's nothing you can do. It's just like, don't even bother. Yeah, of course. The thing with me and it, you know, kind of, this isn't as fun a question as you said, Scott, because it reminds me, I've torn both my calves.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's no big deal. I'm just joking. I'm just messing with you. But I can't, the calves are like one of the great sort of mysteries of how to make them grow in bodybuilding. And now I've been denied that because I don't, you know, have muscle there to try to make grow because it's just been torn.
That got unfun real quick.
Yeah. Jesus. Right. Like talking about chest growth and I don't have any pecs. They've been torn up from the bone. But that they did grow from DC training. It just got to be that, you know, continue with that. And this is it's not supposed to be a knock on DC training, but this is a good example of why variety in training is important. Creating novelty of stimulus is what I was doing. I was just, you know, I tried to get everything I possibly could out of DC training. That's why I did it for so long.
Yeah.
And I built up to doing, I think I was having like 10 plates on a leg press for the DC calves, like 10 on a side. Like almost a fully loaded leg press in many cases.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it was. It was ridiculous. And I was starting to have SI joint problems because I was just in that position. I was using some crappy leg presses that didn't have great padding, and it was sort of driving my SI joint in a certain area for so long, and at one angle, and I stopped getting growth from that. And eventually, I started doing like rest pause training, more traditional stuff, and some other things. But I did that for persisted, doing what had worked for years. It had worked, but it just stopped working. Even though I was adding load, it just wasn't enough novelty in that stimulus. Going from, you know, maybe 4 or 5 plates initially to 8 plates, let's say. I have to go back and look at my logbooks to say, you know, more specifically, that worked. But then the next 2 years of going from 8 to 10 plates didn't do much for me. There wasn't enough extra load there. And I sort of kind of maxed out, like in a way, what my skeleton could handle, because I was like kind of hurting myself.
Yeah.
My low back, I was having to find like extra padding and trying to make this somewhat comfortable. Although those were never comfortable. Those were just absolutely brutal.
Right.
Yeah. So one of the things, and this is what Dante had hooked in with there, and I've applied this with people too, you know, calves can be very, very stubborn. There's interesting observational things when it comes to calves. One, heavier people who've been obese, especially for years, who have been somewhat active at least, have chronically been loading their calves with lots of weight because they're heavy. And that probably is why they have larger calves, at least to some degree. And I say that because a lot of those people, if they were just had a generic proclivity for large, having a lot of muscle mass, and some of them do, they're just naturally big people, you would see obese people that also look like they carried a shitload of muscle everywhere.
Yeah.
And they don't. It's in their calves. Because they're not doing any upper body exercise to elicit growth there. They'd have big chests and big delts. They just look like a power lifter. They look like power lifters do. And they'd have big calves and big thighs and big glutes and everything else. But they only have big calves is really all that's there.
Yeah.
Because they're not running. They're not getting a lot of loading, but they are getting calf loading. Then, of course, there's the people who walk on their toes all the time.
Yep.
You and I have talked about this. I think you fall in this category.
Yep. That's what I did when I was a kid. And I think it made a difference for sure.
And your calves are just ridiculous.
They're unproportionately big.
Yeah. I was probably even a pain in your ass sometimes because you hit some leg shots or, you know, when your legs are on display on stage and your calves outshine your quads.
Scott, I told you about how I hurt my back and I couldn't do like, I couldn't do any kind of quad or hamstring training for a long period. Put it this way, I quit bodybuilding altogether for over a year because of my back pain. I just thought I could never train legs again. When I came back for about 6 months, I said to myself, you know what? I'll just be one of those guys that doesn't train legs. I still had huge calves. It didn't change. I had no quad. My calves, I think they outshined. They dominated. They were almost as big as my upper leg at that time.
Wow.
It was, I'll find a picture for you. Cause it was, it was not good. You
know? Right.
It's like the Popeye leg, really.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So, I mean, are there other people in your family that have really big calves?
My mom has decent calves. I think, you know what? I've got some family from like Czech Republic, Polish area. I think it's the Eastern Bloc in me. All went to my lower leg. That's what I think it is. My mom does. I think my grandma did. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I was just wondering, it's, you know, an interesting thing because this is a whole kind of other broad topic to delve into, but there's possible epigenetic changes that can happen that are a function of the loading or anything that produces growth or a stimulus for growth early on that would explain why you're able to hold on to those calves. It's one potential function, one potential mechanism of muscle memory. And this is what, like I mentioned before, my friend who started bench pressing when she was like six or something like that. And she could bench press 285, really untrained, weighing 135 when she was in college because she'd bench press every day. And those epigenetic changes, and people don't know what that is, basically those are sort of changes in the proteins that surround and encapsulate the DNA base pairs that moderate to some degree the extent to which those genes are expressed. So histone, methylation, and things like that. If you type that in as a search term, you'll find a lot of stuff there. So those things can change. And actually in the satellite cells, those things can change. We know satellite cells are important for muscle growth. They've done a study with runners. They took long distance runners who've been running for years, and they took a muscle biopsy, cultured the satellite cells, which had never been functioning muscle cells. They're just satellite cells, but they'd have been exposed to this high physical activity environment. High physical activity improves insulin sensitivity. And when they cultured the satellite cells in culture, let them develop into functioning, contracting muscle cells, or at least made them in the myotubes, and they measured their insulin sensitive, their glucose uptake, they were better than control cultured satellite cells. So these cells never contracted. They never exercised, but they behaved when they were allowed to develop into functioning muscle cells like they had been previously trained because they've been exposed to a training environment. So all that activity in your calves, if that was an activity related phenomenon, could have programmed your satellite cells and or your cells epigenetically for more growth once you start training. And on satellite cells themselves are another mechanism of muscle growth. So there's something to say for that. And those are two things that are not a function strictly of your genetics per se. Like, you know, sometimes you can have epigenetic changes that will dictate whether this is one of the reasons they first started digging into this is you'll have twins, one of whom will get cancer and the other one won't. That was due to some obviously environmental exposure to a carcinogen, but it shows up as a change in the epigenetics such that the oncogenes, the cancer-causing genes, express themselves. Because the person was exposed to something that changed their epigenetics, not their genetics. Genetic changes, mutations can also cause cancer, like you're exposed to radiation, what have you. But so it's not all genetics that dictate how a cell functions. So no, it's not 100% genetics.
How do you define the word epigenetics? Because I hear it and I kind of understand it, but I feel like you could explain that to me in a way I'd understand it better.
Oh, easiest way is look at the portions of the word. So epi, like, you know what an epiphenomenon is?
No, I don't.
Oh, so epi means or basically around.
Okay.
It's something circumscribing something or outside of something.
Okay.
So epigenetics is sort of the next layer up above genetics. So epigenetics are basically, it's just a study. I can't give you the best definition. This isn't my area of expertise, but
yeah.
Epigenetics or epigenetic phenomena are phenomena related to changes in the chromatin protein.
Okay.
The proteins that surround the actual genome, the genetic material.
I see.
That impact to what extent and how and the ways in which the genetic material actually is expressed.
I see. I gotcha. Yeah. That's what I thought you were going to. I just wanted, I thought it was a good spot. Because here's the thing, Scott.
Sure.
I feel like I thought I got that, but I want to stop you. That's my new, that's my new thing. I'm going to stop you,
man.
And I want to ask. I want to ask because I want to learn. And so,
yeah, and I'm sure people are thinking, thank God he stopped him. What the hell is he talking about?
Well, I need to do that more often, I think.
Yeah, because, that's cool.
I'm sure if I'm asking, there's a few other people. And it doesn't completely relate to what we're talking about here, but it does. And I don't know.
Yeah.
I just figure
people can always rewind, you know, and play it again and again. But no, that's, we should do that. I try to like intentionally give as much bang for the buck, knowing they can go back and replay it.
Yeah.
You know, if they want to listen again. Rather than having me, you know, go extra slow. But yeah, that's a good question. So epigenetics is sort of at a layer above the genetics, layer of genetics.
So would epigenetics be like if I played soccer as a kid and ran a lot and was on and ran on my toes?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that would be, so there would be something like this example with the runners, you know, that I talked about where they actually culture the satellite cells.
Yeah.
Found okay. Epigenetic changes there. Like if you have, you can confer, another example would be, they've done a lot of this stuff in animals, is you can confer kind of a cellular memory and even immunity, to offspring of mice based on what the mother was exposed to when the offspring were in utero. So, yeah. So, and they've like, how does this happen? Like, what's the mechanism for this enhanced immune response, for instance?
Yeah.
And when they go and look, it's like, well, you know, they don't have the immune cells. They don't have more immune cells. They don't have, you know, they're not carrying antigens.
Yeah.
But something there are examples of, cases where they found, there's more or there's less methylation in these histone proteins that surround the DNA material. And that will impact how easily those genes become activated, transcribed, and translated.
Okay.
There's actually stuff like, some of the human stuff is pretty crazy. So they've actually, I think they've done with cadavers, but like when kids are exposed to violence. I'm going to bastardize some of this. This is kind of far askew of the stuff that I dig in most of the time, but I remember looking, this is pretty cool. You can look this up, and there's a number of studies. It's kind of a big area of study. Like kids who are exposed to violence as when they're younger, display different, patterns of electrical activity in their brains. Things like the amygdala light really easily. That's sort of a fear center, fear and aggression center. Is a really kind of generic way of putting it.
Yeah.
One of the things that explains why that behavior persists long after the initial series of traumas that seem to precede it are epigenetic changes. It's like a way for those neurons to remain more sensitive to traumatizing events and a way for the brain to be more reactive to, you know, someone, a big person with long hair and a beard, you know, if their dad was a guy with long hair and a beard who used to beat them,
yeah,
they're hypersensitive to big people with long hairs and beards, whatever, you know. Some of those changes that in severely traumatized kids are epigenetic changes. They found epigenetic differences between traumatized and non-traumatized in the areas of the brain that are differentially activated and become active in different circumstances that are similar to what they were exposed to that was traumatic as a kid.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So your body's remembering these things. It's sort of like saying, okay, It's kind of like, you know, the whether or not the door is open is whether or not the gene's turned on. And epigenetics, I don't want to like confuse people with the lock and key hypothesis, but it's sort of like kind of like here in my aunt's house, she's got double locks on the doors, you know, because sometimes she travels. Like she's got like sliding glass doors and the locks are crappy on those. Yeah. She's got the door, you know, the lock down below, you know, and
yeah,
a regular door lock. Well, she's got double lock. It's kind of almost like in order to actually turn the gene on, you have to undo the lock, you know, that's at the handle because you got to pull on the handle. That's how you actually, you know, that promoter binds the gene and like starts the transcription of the gene. But an epigenetic change means, you know, oh, in order to get at that, you got to move. Here's a better. You got to move the curtain out of the way. An epigenetic change is like opening the curtain so you can see the door and unlock the door and open it. That's kind of what that is. It doesn't like whether the curtain's open or closed doesn't turn the gene on or off.
Right.
But you can't open. You're not gonna be able to do a very good job opening the door unless the curtain's out of the way.
Yeah.
You can see the handle and where the lock is. That's what epigenetic changes do. They make the door more easily opened when the appropriate signal comes in, promoter or whatever it is that's involved with turning that gene on.
That makes sense.
Yeah, it's interesting stuff. One thing I wanted to mention, though, back on the calves thing, just so people don't miss it, because people want to know how to get calves bigger, is Dante was on the right track, though, I think. One thing I've done with a few people, Jordan has done something like this before. Dave has done something like this for Dave Henry's for his legs, is focusing on metabolic stress. If you look on Elite FTS, I wrote an article called Rust Proofing the Iron Warrior.
Okay.
I think it's called. And I talk about a way to do sort of blood flow restriction where you do reps and then you hold and do reps and then you hold and then you reps and you hold. So instead of like using a tourniquet to occlude blood flow, which just has it pool while you're resting, which carries some risk of clot, which I'm not too keen on suggesting people do, you can do things where you're prolonging the set using metabolic stress, like to do some reps and do a hold, do some reps and do a hold, kind of like the pump sets in fortitude training. And that type of training has worked for people.
Okay.
Up the calves before. And it's different than people like high reps. High reps are favorable for calves for a reason because they tend to work. That's a metabolic stress focused deal there. And then just variety, of course.
Yeah.
The people that have sort of the universal good approach for bringing up weak calves that people say is that they make them a focus, they train them frequently, and they train them with kind of an undulating periodization type of approach where they do high, low, and middle loads, high reps, lots of painful, like kick yourself in the ass.
Yeah.
And heavy stuff, make them strong and make them fatigue resistant and just punish them. But don't tear them. That's what happened to me, obviously. So that's the bottom line as far as calves go, is you'll have to try something you haven't been doing.
That sounds like the bottom line for every body group, doesn't it?
Yeah. If what you've been doing ain't working, then you got to try something else.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Pretty much.
All right. Well, what do you have going on for the rest of the day, Scott?
I think I'm gonna take my pups to the dog park. There's one dog park here in town, and my when my dog Rusty passed, both my aunt and my mom and dad put a little memorial out there for him, I believe. Oh,
nice.
Yeah, I want to take his sisters out there.
Oh, that's cool, man.
Yeah.
Well, I hope you enjoy yourself. I hope you enjoy the rest of your stay in Quincy. When are you heading home?
Tomorrow. I should be home by the time this gets out, I think.
Ah, excellent. Perfect, man.
What about you? What's your plan for the day?
I am going to the post office. And that's not a plug, but that's to say, hey, guys, if you want to, we have T-shirts at Advices Radio on the website. And I will be sending them out personally. But awesome. I'm going up there and I'm debating, Scott, because normally I take 2 days off a week from training, and today could be one of those days, but I don't feel like taking the day off. But the way my days are lining up, I'm training back tomorrow and I don't have a good workout that I could do. So I think I'm going to have to not train, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sounds like it. Sounds like that's where, yeah, unfortunately.
Unfortunately. Yeah. I'd love to get in the gym, but hey.
Well, if your calves are weak, you could just go train calves, but that's not the issue. So.
Right, yeah.
I don't got any solutions for you, man.
Guys, for Dr. Scott Stevenson, fortitudetraining.net, I'm Scott McNally with the Advices Radio Network. This has been another episode of Muscle Minds, and we will see you soon.
Adios.
Voices Radio Network.